This is Deb Donig with Technically Human, a podcast about ethics and technology, where I ask what it means to be human in the age of tech. Each week, I interview industry leaders, thinkers, writers, and technologists, and I ask them about how they understand the relationship between humans and the technologies we create. We discuss how we can build a better vision for technology, one that represents the best of our human values.
Today, I am speaking with the author Mike Trigg about his new novel, Burner. Mike Trigg is an author, a novelist, a tech executive, a tech founder, and an investor in dozens of technology startup companies for over 25 years. His first novel, BitFlip, was released in August of 2022 to critical acclaim, lauded by the San Francisco Chronicle as a, quote, twisty, acerbic, corporate thriller. His work has been featured in Publishers Weekly, Kirkus, and Literary Hub. He has been a contributor to TechCrunch, Entrepreneur, and Fast Company, and frequently posts on his author site, www.miketrigg.com.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Deb. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Excited to get into this conversation.
Me too.
I want to spend the bulk of our time today talking about your novel, Burner, which I think I'd want to talk about in the context of literature. But first, I'd love to ask you some questions about what got you to writing fiction in the first place. You come out of a background in tech and building startups and investing. So why fiction? Why writing at all?
Yeah, it was actually a pretty early interest of mine. I took a creative writing class in undergraduate and loved it. And, you know, sort of had this early aspiration to become a fiction writer. Felt like I can't make a living doing that. And so I got into adjacent career, writing adjacent fields. I got into public relations. I worked at Capitol Hill for a while. And that led me to ultimately to the tech industry, which is a longer story. But I always had this, I always harbored this interest in writing a novel. And I was starting to do it, actually. I would get home and tell, you know, stories over the dinner table with my wife about what happened in my day. And she would say, you know, gosh, these are interesting stories. You should write a novel about. And so I started keeping those little anecdotes, and eventually I was just sort of stonewalled. I wasn't making progress. And for me, a silver lining to COVID was gave me the chance to really just jump in with both feet and go do it. I was already at home. I'd shut down a startup I was working on. And I thought, this is the universe telling me, you know, this is a chance to go do this finally. And so I wrote my first novel, BitFlip, which came out in August of 22. And then have my second novel coming out right now here this spring.
I'm trying not to give away too many spoilers here, but I wonder if you could share a quick summary of the plot of Burner, which I think will help our listeners understand what we're talking about and give some context for the rest of this episode in the absence of those listening to the show having read the book first.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the title Burner refers to a couple things, actually. It refers to, first and foremost, a online persona called Burner911, which is the anonymous leader of this kind of alt-right populist movement online. And in the opening scene, one of our two main protagonists, Shane, is under arrest for being the alleged mastermind behind this movement that has culminated in a massive riot on the streets of San Francisco. Simultaneous to that, the daughter of a tech billionaire, Chloe Corbin, is abducted by the followers of this movement. And unbeknownst to anybody, Chloe and Shane are secretly in a relationship. So the story really alternates between those two first-person points of view, each in captivity of their own, each trying to sort of, Shane especially, undo what he's sort of inadvertently done, this movement that spiraled out of his control. In the final analysis, it's really sort of a tragic love story and representative of the polarized political climate that we find ourselves in.
I wanted to ask you a few follow-up questions about that title, Burner, because Burner also seems, at least to me, to indicate one of the primary ambitions of at least one group of so-called maybe quasi-protagonists in the novel who want to, in a sense, burn it all down, right? It's kind of an anarchist streak that's given a point of view and given a kind of fleshing out in the novel. How do you think about that idea of burning it all down? And the novel gives that point of view a kind of fair amount of respect. Now, of course, as a professor of English literature, I am well-versed in the idea that just because a novelist gives a point of view time to be fleshed out. And representation does not mean that somebody is necessarily behind that point of view. But certainly it seems like part of the perspective of the novel is that wealth inequality and the kind of dominance of the tech industry and some of its hypocrisies, as well as some of its bravado, needs to be taken down a little bit. And that kind of anarchy, that idea of burning it all down, the kind of idea of taking down these titans, seems to be given some gravitas. I'm wondering how you think about that in the context of what we are seeing in Silicon Valley and how far you as a novelist stand behind that point of view that you've given representation space, even if not a kind of overt sympathy.
Yeah, well, that's definitely a second, meaning to the title is kind of this, I'd say, ultimately ineffective and destructive philosophy of burning it all down. And frankly, it's something you see on sort of both the extreme right and the extreme left, where the thought process and the political rhetoric, no longer focuses on solutions and what to do and how to solve some of these intractable problems, but really sort of has this defeatist attitude that, everything should just be destroyed or dumped. I don't believe that at all. As I mentioned, I started my career in politics. I am a firm believer in the democratic process. I think that, the term that I use for a lot of what we see in our political discourse right now is troll governance, where, there aren't proposals, there aren't platforms, there aren't points of view. There's just anti. And I find that that is very pernicious and very detrimental to doing what needs to be done in a democracy, which is find common ground and compromise on proposals that'll move our government and our country and our society forward.
Well, I want to dig in a little bit further into that question, because the politics of the book are worth discussing. That incentive that we just discussed to burn it all down that characterized the motivations of the movement described in your book aren't fully that of the current left or the current right in strict senses, although I think that both of them have their own refrains of burn it all down. But rather, the politics of the book seem to bear features of both of those things, the conspiracy theorism of the Donald Trump right, the anger at wealth equality of the Bernie Sanders left, and the free speech absolutism of, and somebody like an Elon Musk, who sometimes seems to be an extremist on both sides. How would you describe the politics of the book?
Yeah, I think I wanted to try to write something from the center. There are definitely a few passages that were hard for me to write and are probably going to be hard for the reader to read because they represent at times extremes and illogical manifestations of beliefs and feelings. But there's kind of an arc to the philosophy of this movement, and this is sort of a big undercurrent of the story, where Shane, the protagonist, sort of starts out, going down this path that's sort of been well documented, kind of red pilling is the phrase you often hear for it, where, thanks to algorithms recommending, next piece of content, trying to keep a user hooked and online, sort of becomes extreme in his ideology, gets a following based on that. And that following ends up sort of taking the movement away from him, if you will. In other words, Shane himself doesn't necessarily have a really strong political agenda. He, if anything, is a little bit self-serving, a little bit egotistical. He's doing this movement really to gain agency that he lacks in his real life. And the oh no moment, sorry, trying to keep it G-rated here or PG-rated, is when his actions have led to the abduction of the woman he loves. This sort of is at the center of the book, this risk that you will, in your pursuit of online esteem and ego and everything else, jeopardize what really matters to you in your life and not even realize that until it's been taken away. And so I really wanted to plunge Shane from the opening chapter into this great state of regret and contrition and finally realizing, what's really important to him, what's important in his life. And the questions throughout the book is, will it be too late?
And I don't want to give too much away for folks who have not yet read and want to read the book. or step away too far from an audience who has not read the book and is still trying to follow along this conversation. But I think one of the major themes in the book is how the kind of big economic, political forces in a culture interact with and then intercept and embed themselves within individual lives. Right? You have the massive amounts of wealth inequality, movements around free speech, the politics of social media discourse online, and a massive kind of turn toward extremism and violent extremism intersecting with two particular small lives, that of Chloe and Shane, and the individuals who follow their movements. So how do you think about the kind of big H history and all of these large forces of politics, of economics, of culture intersecting with the small individual, small H histories or the small lives of those who bear out in immediate ways and in personal ways, those currents of history and those currents of politics and those currents of culture, those currents of economics?
I think this is one of the most challenging elements of modern, political discourse, right? In many ways, what's happened with social media and the tools that are at everyone's fingertips today are incredibly empowering. You know, we've seen really positive things in terms of the average person having a voice, being able to express their opinion, being able to truly exercise their rights of freedom of speech. And yet, at the same time, we've seen those platforms be exploited, manipulated, used to spread disinformation, misinformation, and worse, hate speech, etc. One of the true challenges is how do you moderate that? You see, the internet is unlimited, and there's always some other platform to go to, and it is extremely difficult to prevent those exact forces, those negative attributes. And so I think we're moving towards some very, sort of a very important next generation of online discourse. If the last 20 plus years was really about, as I said, giving the average person a voice, I do think we're moving to a period of time where we're going to have to reestablish trust and truth so that we don't sort of throw in the towel and say, gosh, I can't believe anything I see or read anymore, even accelerated now with generative AI technologies and everything else, but instead let the good of that platform and the power of that come through so that we can be better informed, be trusting in the information that we're getting, that it's truthful, that it's accurate. And I don't have answers on all those things, but I think those are really important points to grapple with. And that was a big theme of the book.
Another way I think of casting that question is to notice that many of the kind of big political, cultural, economic questions in the novel take place in Silicon Valley. That is context for both of us. We as individuals, inside of that milieu, watching these large historical forces as undercurrents to our own lives. And as we were chatting before the show, I think you mentioned that you're in Portola Valley. I grew up in the same area, and you were saying that your son is just graduating high school on his way to college. My guess is that he probably went to the same Melo Atherton High School that I went to as well.
So, go Bears.
Go Bears, indeed. And so I guess I was wondering, or if you could talk a little bit about what you were seeing in Silicon Valley, broadly speaking, or in the context of your everyday life as an individual on a micro scale that led you to understand and portray, as you do, the cultural context of the novel. What were you seeing or noticing or understanding in your everyday surroundings and in your life in Silicon Valley and in this particular epicenter of tech culture that you wanted to sharpen or highlight in the novel and in the context of the novel's drama and the context of the novel's commentary and critique on politics and economics and ethics, indeed, and technological innovation?
Absolutely. I mean, you're hitting on a key reason that I got into writing novels in the first place. I mean, I spent 20 plus years in the tech industry, including at a major social networking site, and did feel like, especially when I first started getting into this, that the criticism of the tech industry wasn't there. We were still at that time, this was in kind of 2015, when I first started having aspirations to write a novel, you know, everything was so celebratory of tech. It was like, you can't, you know, making the world a better place was sort of the mantra of every tech company. And there were no negative externalities to the tech industry. And I think, you know, the last decade or so has really started to shine a light on some of the negative aspects of the tech industry. My first book, BitFlip, I describe as a corporate thriller. And it is about, you know, offers many of those cultural critiques about not just tech companies, but the Bay Area more generally, the culture around tech industry and some of the challenging dynamics that I think a lot of people don't realize exist within startup companies that can sort of lead to bad behavior, structural challenges that can lead to bad behavior. And we see plenty of those. You know, you saw FTX, you saw Theranos, there have been some really high profile examples of tech companies that have basically been completely fraudulent. You know, I think with Burner, my lens was a little bit different. Definitely my lane as a writer is examining the impact of the tech industry on modern life, both the novels that are set here in the Bay Area, both the novels are contemporary. Where I really want to delve into with Burner is social media's impact on that and how both the good and the bad of that. And I think that there's a profit incentive in tech companies and these platforms that makes it very difficult for them to live up to the responsibilities that I think they have. You know, the reason we've gotten to this place is that the ad-driven sales business model and the fact that if you work at Facebook or Twitter or YouTube or anyplace else, you pretty much have a singular lever for increasing revenue, which is to keep your users online more, get them to click on more stuff. And so that naturally leads to algorithms and features that drive that behavior, keep the user hooked online so that they can serve up more ads. And for some individuals online, that can become these sort of rabbit holes where they get more and more sort of extreme. They view and consume content that only sort of validates and affirms their pre-existing beliefs and therefore sort of galvanizes those beliefs. And I think that, you know, nobody in the tech industry on these social media platforms was really thinking about that. It was viewed as, oh, this is going to be great. People will get their media through their friends and their friends will help guide them to what's useful and interesting. But there's definitely this huge negative side effect that has happened after the fact. A lot of platforms are still not doing a good job of moderating. They're getting criticized, of course, for censorship and all these sorts of things. And I think it's a real dilemma. I think it's a real, real challenge that we have to kind of figure out, or I think you'll see what we've already seen, which is increasing just distrust of the platforms themselves and the information that people are getting on those platforms.
Well, I want to dig into this a little bit further because the book does really pivot around some questions about free speech, as well as the kind of counter argument about censorship. And the book specifically mentions the kind of key piece of legislation around which these questions orbit. That is Section 230, the 1996 law that has served as the basis for free speech claims by social media companies, a rationale for allowing oftentimes destructive speech or destructive speakers such as Alex Jones to be platformed by these companies without consequence, since Section 230 prevents these companies online from being held legally liable for user content posted on their sites. Of course, as a side, my cynical sense of this is that this Section 230 provision provides a kind of permission structure for companies to not have to do the work of content moderation in any other way than that which they choose to do voluntarily, or that which they potentially view as harmful to their revenue or advertising capacities, or that which is otherwise illegal, such as speech that directly induces or calls for specific forms of violence against specific individuals. Of course, the work of content moderation is very difficult. It's very costly. It's very time consuming. It slows down the shipping of products. So it is in these companies, I think, best financial interests to not have to wade into the muddy waters of content moderation, in addition to not only potential revenue loss, but also potential angering of, you know, important political figures who tend to be very vindictive, who will not on this podcast be named. So How does Berner's narrative think about or assess the validity of a provision such as Section 230 or the kinds of arguments or counterarguments around this kind of free speech specter? Now, of course, these are private companies. I like to think of Section 230's claims as a kind of cipher or a false red herring, because, of course, private companies are allowed to decide what or who they want to platform on their social media environments as much or as little as they want. But this is, of course, a very convenient way out of having to make those claims political claims. Again, what's your take on this? What is your thought process around these questions of free speech?
It's a thorny one. You know, I agree with you completely. I would not present myself as by any means a legislative expert, but I do think that Section 230 has been something that many social media companies have hidden behind. At some level, you're absolutely right, because there is a profit incentive. There's a user who's driving a lot of views, driving a lot of clicks. They kind of want that content on their platform. You know, that is an inherent dilemma that a lot of the big social media platforms find themselves in. I am actually, and from I say this from firsthand experience, a firm believer in verification, identity, et cetera. I think that establishing trust on a platform and safety on a platform, you know, so to use that term broadly in every sense of it, is critical to the user's enjoyment of that platform. And I think there's kind of an interesting little case study in that, in the site Reddit. You know, Reddit was sort of a dumpster fire, took a view of free speech to the extreme, allowed for proliferation of incredibly toxic subreddits on their platform, didn't do a very good job of content moderation at all. And they were sort of a forgotten company, I'd say, you know, lost. And, you know, I not being a full-throated advocate for everything on Reddit by any stretch, but the leadership at Reddit, as the founder came back, they really did put content moderation at the forefront. They killed entire subreddits, just shut them down, blocked users. And the company had its IPO recently. You know, it was, I think, an interesting little microcosm that users want trust. They want forums where they're not going to be attacked. They want trolls, for lack of a better term, to not be on the platform. There's a strong desire for good, constructive rhetoric online. And I think that a lot of the platforms have sort of worried that if they're going to get into the content moderation game, that they're going to get criticized, overly criticized. I think that's a false worry. I think that they should embrace that. And, you know, you're never going to stop that. That content will always have somewhere else to go. Those users will always have someplace else to spew the most, you know, objectionable hate speech, whatever it might be, but it doesn't need to be on your platform. And in fact, the majority of your users will find it refreshing for that content to be gone rather than to be permitted in the name of free speech.
I guess not to give away again too much of the plot, but it does seem like some of the very popular revenue driving speech online as represented in the novel does ultimately result in some very violent acts that really kind of launch the rest of the plot. So I'm wondering how you think about those kinds of politics. Again, we're not talking about speech that drives people off platforms. And I think that companies are very good at figuring out what speech drives people off platforms. And even if they are not going to content moderate, they certainly do things like algorithm amplification or de-amplification that allows them to monetize speech that is helpful, again, for their revenue model, and deprioritize speech that is not helpful or destructive to their revenue model without having to wade into content moderation policy. But in the case, again, to go back to what is represented within Berner, there does seem to be a kind of zealotry to a form of speech that ultimately does turn very violent. So what is your thinking about that dimension of the free speech argument? Again, you're presenting free speech as something that is in alignment with the public's best interest as well as the best financial interest of a company. But what about in the cases where it's not?
You're precisely right. This was another one of those provocative questions that I wanted to raise in the book. you know, we've seen it unfortunately play out in real life many times where rhetoric is used online or otherwise and directly or indirectly incites acts of violence. And to me, those are the two things that have to be the guardrails of free speech is truth and responsibility, right? Yeah, I think that freedom of speech is a right that we should cherish. It is a unique element in the United States that we are privileged to have. But with any great privilege comes responsibility, to use a Spider-Man quote, I think that is. It needs to be truthful. I don't believe that freedom of speech protects the right to, you know, we have rules against libel and slander. It is not the right to lie. It is not the right to spread misinformation. And similarly, there's great responsibility to it. I think if the rhetoric and speech that you are espousing or advocating or sharing has the potential to incite violence, the potential to incite hate crimes, et cetera, I do not believe that's protected. And so I think that is, again, where we're evolving in our online communications and culture is towards those things. And that's, you know, I touched on this point just a little bit ago around verification and validity, right? So one of the big things that I found in the social media platform that I worked on, which was a site called High Five, is that users become much less toxic when they are them their real selves. One of the secrets, there used to be dozens and dozens of social media platforms, MySpace and Bebo and Orkut and on down the list, Friendster, et cetera. And one of the main reasons that Facebook on the consumer side, LinkedIn on the business side, sort of broke away from the pack is that they established a culture of using your real name, using your real identity, and therefore that mere fact reduced, you know, the hate speech, reduced the toxicity of those online dialogues. Not a panacea by any stretch, but that for me was a real lesson in my personal experience where I saw, okay, if you know, when you interact with somebody in real life, you have decorum. You have, usually, not always, but usually you moderate what you're saying a little bit because you know what you say and do reflects on you personally. And so that is really important to freedom of speech online. And I think if we don't guardrail it, as I describe it, we start to lose it, right? It starts to become too polarized, too untrustworthy, too biased, and we therefore start to do the worst thing, which is we tune it out. And I think that you have to have, you know, again, with that great, great privilege comes great responsibility.
Okay, so the next question, I am a little bit hesitant to ask, so I'll caveat with two important points before I get into the question. The first is that I don't really believe that novels have the responsibility to give us sympathetic characters. I'm not sure that it's the responsibility of an author to make us like the people of the book. And the second part is that in literary scholarship and in literary studies, we have a maxim called the death of the author. That doesn't mean that you're dead. You're very much alive. I'm looking at you. And as listeners are listening to this podcast, I can assure you that Mike Trigg is 100% alive. But the death of the author really refers to this idea that when we read a book, the intentions of the author or the biography of the author shouldn't matter to our evaluation of and our interpretation of the book. That is to say, things like authorial intention don't really matter. What an author meant to say is not important. What is important is what is in the book. What the author meant to have the novel mean is not as important as what the text in and of itself as a circumscribed, hermetically sealed body of art that we, the interpreters as readers, pick up. That is what is important. But I want to ask you two questions anyway. The questions are, first of all, given that I've already confessed that I found very few of the characters in the novel, in fact, none of the characters in the novel, particularly sympathetic, and also given the point that I have already put forward, which is that your opinion doesn't really matter as the author, which of these characters do you find sympathetic? Where do you locate your authorial point of view or your sympathies or your perspectives in the midst of the kind of maelstrom of personalities and dramas and activities of this particular novel and points of view represented by this novel.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'd start by saying I'm a big fan of flawed protagonists. I think that, you know, everybody, there is no such thing as a perfect person. Everybody has a little bit of good and bad in them. As I wrote my first novel, this was one of the hardest things for me to do as an author, was to have my lead character do things that I would not do, right? And believe things that I do not believe. That separation, as you call it, death of the author, is hard. You know, when you imagine your parents or your mother-in-law reading a book, you're like, gosh, I don't want her to think I think this because the main character does X, Y, Z. And so in both in Bit Flip and in Burner, they're flawed protagonists for sure. I also think that, you know, nobody wants to be preached to. And I think that there's a risk in literature, if it becomes too Stiltonen's point of view, it can sound pedantic. And so the way I sort of approach my books is to try to not put, you know, obviously I have, you know, strong point of view. And I, the reason I'm writing these novels is to convey that point of view. But I'm really trying to raise questions more than offer an opinion. Yeah, I want the novel to be thought-provoking rather than declaratively saying, oh, you know, Mike, the author, thinks X, Y, Z. You know, based on what I write on my website at miketrigg.com, you know, someone could probably pretty easily discern my political points of view. But another really important part of the novel for me was to try to write it, you know, again, from sort of a centrist viewpoint, from a balanced viewpoint, if you will, to not come in with a strong belief that, you know, any of either side of our political landscape is right or wrong, but to sort of just raise these questions, raise these issues, put forth this core question of how are we going to move forward in a democratic country unless we sort of have the ability to come to common ground, have the ability to compromise, have the ability to, if not agree with, at least listen to, empathize, understand the point of view of people who have different opinions from ourselves, and to try to not vilify. I think a lot of the book is about, you know, the other, right? That every character sort of gets in a position where they sort of see these pockets of the other, like groups that they can dislike, and I think that's, you know, that's not good. That's not good for our society. It's not good for political discourse in general. To your question about sympathetic characters, the book has three first-person narrators. Shane, who's the alleged leader of this online movement. Chloe, who is an Instagram celebrity in her own right and is the victim of this abduction in the book. And then Wayne, who's this kind of interesting intermediary character. Wayne is the lawyer for Shane. And I won't spoil too much about it, but he becomes sort of this intermediary to try and allow Shane, who's on an internet embargo, and Chloe, who's in a safe house with her kidnappers, to communicate again. And he becomes a very, you know, a character that you don't know if you can trust as well. And so, you know, they're each flawed. They're each have an element of sympathy, I hope, in that you understand that they've sort of made their own bed. They've sort of created a situation that has put their own lives and relationships in peril. And yet, you know, you sort of root for them to get through that and find a path back to each other in the case of Shane and Chloe.
I mean, to play a little bit of devil's advocate, each of these characters could also be equally construed, I would argue, as villains. Shane is, by all accounts, potentially the leader of a terrorist ring. Chloe is the daughter, a kind of Patty Hearst-styled character, of a tech billionaire who is kind of cosplaying as a rebel in a way that, at least in the novel, straddles authenticity and, as I said, LARPing, her cosplaying. And then Wayne is a character who pretends on the surface to be a kind of neutral arbiter or state-appointed advocate, And yet at the same time, we learn is, and again, I don't want to give too much away, but certainly hiding his own incentive structures that are not to be trusted as well. So given that each of these characters could be a villain, and then I think there's other kind of historical figures and historical forces lurking about, what or who is the villain of this novel? What's the antagonist, or who is the antagonist of this novel? Or is everybody an antagonist? And kind of, again, to put a emphasis on the title of the book, Burner, burn it all down, because none of these people are particularly likable or particularly, you know, desirable as characters.
Shane is arguably the antagonist, even though he's the first narrator, he's kind of one of the three primary POV characters. But in the classic sense of antagonist, you know, he has put in motion the negative elements that are the triggering, you know, storyline of this book. You know, not to spoil my first book, but Sam, who's the character in that book, is also both protagonist and antagonist. And that was very deliberate. That was very intentional. Apart from the broader belief that I articulated earlier, that each of us has a little good and bad in us, in particular with Shane and Chloe, you know, they're kind of wrestling with their online personas and their real world personas the entire time, right? There's this constant tension between, and obviously sort of to the degree each is both the protagonist and antagonist, that's sort of what you get in them, is their the compulsion that they have around their online identities lead them to act in somewhat self-destructive ways. And so that is a statement, obviously, about how we live our lives online, how those online experiences can be not necessarily representative of real world feelings. I think a lot of the mental health issues that have, you know, been brought to light around social media are exactly that, where people are consuming these curated lives of friends of theirs, and that leads to this perception that they need to curate at the same pace and with the same inauthenticity about what their lives really are like. It can lead to very low self-esteem, or self-esteem that is propped up with the sort of false narratives that are presented in their online, people's online experiences. And so I wanted to shine a light on that. I wanted to have two characters who were sort of their representative extremes of having this incredible sort of success and notoriety and fame, if you will, in their online personas, but have those online personas be fundamentally at direct odds with what they need in their real life, what their true person needs. And that's where, again, I hope there can, you know, the reader can find sympathy in these characters, is that recognition that, you know, they've sort of done this to themselves. They've made their own beds, and they, even as they start to recognize that, it's still hard for each of them to stop, to, you know, rectify that situation and really get to what I believe is most meaningful in life, which is finding friends and partners and loved ones that you can share life's experiences with.
I will say that I think the aperture of sympathy for me comes through by way of noticing that, kind of, if you take a step back from the novel, all of these characters are, in a sense, kind of being puppeteered in a larger drama by two billionaires who essentially are playing around with the loss or win of what for them is insubstantial amounts of money that amount to an amusing gambling trick, whereby, you know, people, the kind of little people around your novel who are populating its content and around whom the drama is pivoted, are being cast about in ways that are far beyond their control, because these two billionaires want to play a little game with one another and, you know, pocket some winnings that ultimately matter very little to them in the meantime. So I guess this gets to some of the interplay between the big H history and the small h history in the novel, and the way that these individuals in a sense, are very limited in their ability to have much agency. And we see Shane, I think, and Chloe try and take up as much agency as they possibly can by way of trying to either burn things all down or, you know, maybe move outside of the character cast in which they have been played to try and do that. But their agency just to me seems so limited in light of the larger game that's kind of carelessly being played around them. I wonder if you could comment on that dimension of the novel and the two billionaires who kind of play off of one another on the side of the novel, but who are really kind of pulling the strings of the novel writ large.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, you know, again, obviously intentional part of the narrative is that there are these sort of forces that you start to understand as you read the book that are as you said, pulling the strings behind the scenes. I didn't fully answer what you asked earlier, sort of what is the sort of political ideology in this? And there is an intentional arc in the posts from this anonymous sort of QAnon type person, which is Shane, the Burner 911 persona. And it sort of starts with that sort of more right-leaning rhetoric, but he actually does find common ground with Chloe around this objection to wealth inequality, right? And the movement in some ways, again, I'm sort of choosing my words carefully because I don't want to give away all the twists and turns, but, you know, there is this sort of alignment that happens, common ground, if you will, that these two people, Shane and Chloe, who come from sort of optically opposite ends of the political spectrum, right? Come to collaborate, come to share this sort of common beliefs. And you're precisely right. Both are effectively sort of victims of puppet masters behind the scenes. And so I feel like that was a very important thing to highlight. I think we have struggled in this country with wealth inequality since forever in the country, obviously. I think at every point in history, I don't know if that's the big H or the small H, but you know, at every point in history, when wealth inequality has become too pronounced, too insurmountable, we've had societal disruptions. And I hope we're not headed towards another societal disruption. But you know, we've been in an era where the wealth that's been created out of the tech industry has been concentrated in a fewer and fewer number of people. And there is a sensibility that Shane rightfully has that, you know, he has a line where he says, you know, the American dream is complete bullshit. I'm sorry. Edit that out if you need to. But, you know, that he feels like, you know, I'm trying to get ahead, but the only way I can do that is in this sort of deceitful, duplicitous way. Gosh, you know, I hope that is not where we get to as a society. People, young people especially, need to feel hope. They need to feel optimism. They need to feel that they can improve their lives, you know, and I hate the phrase get ahead, but, you know, achieve things in their life that they want to achieve. And when there are structural challenges and impediments to that, it can be extremely discouraging, extremely negative on a society. And I do believe there are those structural impediments right now. If there is a strong point of view, that is it, basically, that there is sort of a common ground around ensuring that we have a fair society. And I think if you look at a lot of the policy decisions that I advocate, I want to see better access to education, better access to healthcare, you know, the things that are, shackling people with debt, impeding their ability to become the best version of themselves. We need to invest in that as a country, as a society. And I think that can go a long way towards rectifying things like wealth inequality.
So here is a question directly about that kind of principal feature of the book, wealth inequality. Burner takes place in Silicon Valley, and it takes place in a tech landscape, but its real subjects don't seem to me to be primarily tech, although tech is a kind of conduit to get into those issues, because tech is, I think, a vector for massive wealth inequality in a place like Silicon Valley that has massive wealth inequality and whose principal city, San Francisco, is more and more, I think, seeing the consequences of that in terms of crime, in terms of homelessness, in terms of a city kind of overrun by human feces on the streets because of that kind of wealth inequality, making it a less fun place for, I think, everybody, especially and including those who lack the means to have a home in the area. So again, this doesn't seem to be primarily a tech story, but it really is a story about finance and the consequences of wealth inequality and for finance in the context of the tech scene and in this technologically pivoted city. So is this a story about tech and about Silicon Valley specifically, or is this a story about the pernicious nature of greed and finance independent of any particular industry? Could Berner, for example, take place in a Lehman Brothers setting in New York or in the stock market zealotry of the 1920s? Or is there something specifically modern and current and tech about this novel?
Great question. Lots to unpack there, so let me try. So I think first of all, you know, the distinction between sort of the financial services space and the technology space is pretty blurry, right? If you look at what has made the tech industry what it is today, there's a whole integrated ecosystem of financial services entities, starting with venture capital, through investment banking, through, you know, NASDAQ Stock Exchange, et cetera, that propel startup companies through those different phases, that are the you know, propellant, the accelerator, the fuel that makes the tech industry possible. It's also obviously the mechanism for creating, you know, sort of unprecedented, spectacular levels of wealth that has had this consequence of making the Bay Area in particular, but really across the country, if not across the world, you know, increasingly feeling sort of like haves and have-nots, where people are either in that ecosystem and propelled forward with high salaries, stock options, et cetera, or they're not. And it's very hard to kind of get into that world. But financially, you know, that those mechanisms have been in place since the birth of the tech industry. And the two industries are very deeply intertwined. For me, one of the things, and this kind of, I'm dating myself a little bit, you know, when I graduated from undergrad in the early 90s, tech industry didn't exist really in its current form. Then it was semiconductors and computers. It wasn't the internet yet. And, you know, the prevailing wisdom, although I would have probably dismissed this if I'd put it so bluntly at the time, was that if you went into Wall Street, you were sort of greedy and you were going to get the money. But that tech was making the world a better place and you could make money, right? And I think there's kind of this underlying hypocrisy a little bit that's been at the root of the tech industry, which is this belief that we're not greedy, right? That we're not sort of in it to make money. And I think that as each sort of subsequent generation of entrepreneurs have come to the Bay Area to pursue careers in tech, that financial ambition has become a little bit more, you know, I think exposed and raw. You know, you see some of the industries, you know, in cryptocurrency or you know, Web 3.0, things that are, you know, the NFT craze that sort of fell by the wayside. But some of these things where you just can't really look at that technology or that industry and say that it's there for anything else besides the creation of wealth for the very few number of individuals that are involved in it. Now, I have been in the tech industry. I think the tech industry has been a wonderful thing for our economy. I think it's done transformative things to the way we live, and there have been incredible positives. And there are many, many, many companies that truly are changing the world, that are producing products that are making the world a better place. But there's too much cynicism. There's too much make a quick buck kind of ethos right now. And, you know, I've been around for a few cycles. I think when that happens, there tends to be an obvious bubble in hindsight, and it tends to burst.
I would say that the central event of the novel really converges these issues of tech and finance and tech as a form of finance or financial technologies in a kind of pivotal event that resembles a GameStop gate-like event. And for those who aren't familiar with the GameStop event, or for those who need a refresher, here's a brief summary. In 2021, a group of Wall Street hedge funds operating on insider market analysis and information began shorting GameStop stock. And shorting, in other words, means that they borrowed against the stock in order to sell it with the view that the price would fall, at which point they would buy the stock and lock in healthy profits. And seeing this and wanting to essentially stick it to these Wall Street firms, a ragtag group of everyday traders led by a Massachusetts dad going by the name of Roaring Kitty took on Wall Street titans. And so upon noticing the shorting activity by these large and wealthy hedge funds, a significant number of online members of this cohort called the Wall Street Bets hatched a plan to buy and hold GameStop stock as a way to drive the stock price higher and to trigger what is known as a short squeeze, whereby the stock borrowed by the hedge funds would have to be legally bought by them in order to command much higher prices, and thus would inflict tremendous losses on those hedge funds. So in the story, the underdogs come out on top, the big bad rich guys wound up at the bottom, and in the process, our heroes expose many of the ways in which the financial system is rigged. And as I said, this plot point, which has its historical analog in the GameStop Gate-like event, is a major pivot point in the plot. So what, in your view, is the legacy of this event, if any, today? And what role do you see it playing in the novel?
Well, I thought it was a fascinating event, and that was a very good recap of it. For those who are interested, there's a great Netflix movie called Dumb Money that is it's not a documentary, but it's represents what happened in that incident. I was pretty fascinated by it. I think, though, that it also represents some of the perils that, you know, the book is all about, right? Which is, there's this sort of empowering moment for the people who rode GameStop up, and all the hype that proliferated on Reddit and other platforms to really artificially prop up GameStop's stock and stick it to the hedge funds that had shorted it. But in the end, kind of what happens in the book is what happened to many of the people in that reality, right? The stock eventually came down. Many people lost a lot of money. People who, you know, were putting in, you know, a lot of the posts, and I read through many of them as part of my research, at least the people were saying they were putting in, you know, their money for their tuition and the last dollars in their bank account. And shorting a stock is a very, obviously it was great exposure for the hedge fund folks, but as the stock wrote up, I think it got in excess of $250 or something like that. You know, if that drops to $2 or $10, it can be incredibly financially punishing for the person who bought it on the come up. And so I think as an event, I think we've seen, you know, sort of many things like this where there is, and this is sort of the tantalizing power of the internet, right? If you organize and you propel a movement forward, you can kind of gain power, gain agency, and yet that can be really dangerous. It can be very ephemeral. It can be very financially, in this case, punishing. And it's the same thing happens in the book, you know, not to spoil that particular part of it, but, you know, Shane sort of leads this rally in the stock price. And as the stock collapses, he becomes so enraged, so embittered that he starts to really sort of double down on his stupidity, if you will. You know, I think that to me, if you ask what is sort of the lasting legacy of that, I think to me, it does really represent the feeling of, you know, disempowerment that many people have, that there's a feeling that, and this phrase is used often in the book, that the deck is stacked against them, that they don't really have a way to get ahead. And that's not a good feeling for people to have. You know, that is a feeling where people start to get very cynical. They start to act in, I don't want to say irrational ways, because in some ways it might be rational, but start to sort of adopt sort of almost a mob mentality, right? And that can lead you to a really bad place,
right?
Both individually and societally.
Right. If there's no way out and the deck is stacked, why not burn it all
right
to the ground?
Correct. And you know, that's, you know, back to a point I made earlier in the broadcast, that to me is the responsibility of government. The responsibility of government is to enable its citizens to be prosperous, right? I mean, that is to have the freedoms, to have the education, healthcare, all the things that we touched on that increasingly are human rights. And I think that is where, you know, I hope we can make progress on those issues so that we don't get to a point where so many people feel disenfranchised, feel like they have no chance to get ahead, look around on social media, feel like everybody else is getting ahead. Why aren't I getting ahead? And then feel more and more sort of willing to act in ways that are destructive, potentially illegal, et cetera, because they feel like they have no other choice.
I don't like to reduce books specifically to their politics or to their ethics, although we've talked a lot about both today, because I don't think that any really great fiction is about politics or written in order to convey a political point of view. And I also don't think that any book of fiction tries to overtly or consciously make a moral point unless that piece of fiction is overtly attempting some form of didacticism. And if it is doing that, it's probably less good than one that principally cares about carefully and thoughtfully imagining its imaginary people and presenting a fair similitude of an imaginary world. But to the extent that an ethical sensibility emerges out of the book, I think it's worth discussing on a show about ethics and tech. Are there ethics that appear important for you to discuss as emergent from Berner's world and its person?
If there's sort of a moral to the story, I guess it's like be good to other people. I know that sounds sort of so trite and kind of overly simplistic in the context of an entire novel, but I think that's what when I sort of step back and I look at what's going on societally, culturally, in mass media and social media, it's not very much be good to other people, and there is a reason for that. Back to social platforms and the unintended consequences of those platforms. I think I use this exact line in the book that hate is more activating than love. You know, that unfortunately human brains are sort of wired to our amygdala to look for threats, to be, you know, there's a reason that clickbait exists, you know, things that are, oh my God, I can't believe that. If that inspires that reaction in you, you read it, you look at it, you click on it, right? And so those activating emotions are pulling society towards less tolerance, less discussion, less collaboration, less concessions, et cetera, and towards more polarization. And I think we've seen that happen for 20 years now. It's been a very pronounced and very frightening issue in our political landscape, I think for most of us since the 2016 election, where we've really seen just how polarized we've become, where you sort of increasingly feel like you don't have a common base in reality of what you're thinking, what you're talking about with other people. And that's, again, that's kind of the moral of the story. It's a tragic story in that the characters sort of may learn that a little bit too late. But, you know, that golden rule of do unto others is, I think, core to a functioning society, core to effective and constructive online discourse and real world discourse and governance. And so I hope that through a cautionary tale, I can shine the light on the need for that.
Of the many things that this novel is, it is also a love story between the two principal characters whose point of view the novel switches between. Why a love story is the background to a story that in many ways is about financial inequalities caused by and widened through the activities and belief systems that stand at the foundations of tech.
Not to make it sound overly symbolic, but I always felt like there was an interesting dynamic between Chloe and Shane's relationship in that they represented sort of the political or polar extremes, right? That they each kind of came to, you know, much of their sort of online personas especially are formed and formulated around sort of their political tribalism, if you will, to some degree. And I liked that. I liked the notion that they found not only common ground, but a relationship, a loving relationship with each other, in spite of those backgrounds. And I wanted that to really contrast and in some ways even contradict their online personas, if you will. And so you find each of them sort of needing to act in a way to propel their online personas forward that may be at odds with what they really need and want in real life. And so I did sort of feel like that was symbolic. And in some ways, if it is a political thriller, that's, I think, one of the core political questions of our time is, can we find that common ground? Can we govern and, you know, from from the center front, you know, not allow our politics to become dominated by extremes. And that's, to many people in this day and age, unsatisfying. The word compromise is practically a four-letter word when it comes to politics. And there's, again, I think good reason for that. And if your concern as a politician or is fundraising and getting votes, fear activates people. And, you know, so much of our rhetoric now has become very fear-based, talking about issues that 90% of the U.S. population can agree on and enacting those policies, frankly, is boring. And in an age of short attention spans, it's just easier to, you know, get people riled up with pithy sound bites that further polarize us rather than the hard work of finding common ground and enacting that.
I think we have time for one last question. I'd like to say that before we can create any technologies or imagine any future, we first have to spend time truly fleshing out our imaginations of that technology or that future. So it matters how we imagine, and it matters how our imagination is cultivated by or prepared through the stories that we know. Help me make a pitch for technologists to read more fiction. What can fiction or the idea of fiction itself or even the novel as a form help us to know or understand about how we build technologically and with what vision to what ends?
I think this is a big problem. I mean, I'm being a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I don't think a lot of people in tech read enough fiction, to be totally honest. I think there's a, and I had this sentiment myself when I was in the tech industry. You're in this mode where you're so trying to optimize everything that you're doing, right? In your workday, and you adopt this belief that everything I do needs to be propelling me forward and teaching me something. And so a lot of people, to the extent they do read in the tech industry, read how to get rich books, basically, right? You know, how to be a better business person, biographies of people who became rich, et cetera. I don't think that that's helping them at all. I think what we need, we're at an inflection point, I believe, in the tech industry and to some degree society at large, where we need philosophy, for lack of a better term, right? We need to start to develop the non-quantitative skill sets, because we're getting into areas with generative AI and other kinds of things that have deep, deep ethical and moral questions to them. And if people in the tech industry who are making those decisions are ill-equipped to think through the consequences of what they're doing and the actions that they're having, that is bad. That's going to lead to suboptimal results. And so I think we're at a point where we need to be more philosophical. We need to be more thoughtful about what it is we're doing, what society we want, and how the actions we're taking today are leading to or discouraging that future.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you so much, Deb. I really enjoyed our discussion.